This is Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell, awakening the world to the power of God's Word. And now here is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
We're glad you're with us on this beautiful day. And we're talking about the stability and health of the American family. Our guest this morning will be Mark Regnerus. And Mark is the Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Texas in Austin. He's written a lot of things, numerous articles that have been really circulating the country. And he is author of Premarital Sex in America. It's a book came out in 2010. Another book called Forbidden Fruit, Sex and Religion in the Lives of American Teenagers. You get a sense this could be a rather hot and interesting conversation this morning, especially when you learn about his latest research. Mark, good morning.
Thanks. How are you?
I'm just great. I'm great. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Sure.
I know you have, over the last several years, found yourself increasingly in the media's public eye.
Yeah.
Because you're dealing with some topics that truly affect all of us. They impact the life of the average person. Certainly, they have an impact on marriage and on the family. These are things that our whole country is talking about. It involves politics, religion, but a lot of personal aspects as well. If you don't mind, I'd like, before we get into the really thick issue of parenting and the issue of marriage that's before us today around the country and on Capitol Hill, let's talk some about some of your earlier writings. And I'd like to begin with Forbidden Fruit, Sex and Religion in the Lives of American Teenagers. What prompted you to get into this whole topic, Mark?
I kind of accidentally backed into it. Nothing dramatic to it. I had completed a dissertation at University of North Carolina over in Chapel Hill, and had written a fairly boring dissertation on how religion shaped adolescent delinquency. Mm-hmm. And from there, I decided, well, let's see what else it shapes in adolescents' lives. And I started writing a book chapter on adolescent sexual decision-making and how religion sort of shaped that or did not. And that got to be a rather long chapter, and I just decided to turn that into what eventually came to be Forbidden Fruit. So it was a pretty tame entry into a rather hot topic.
Yes. The whole idea that sexuality shapes decision-making for teenagers, I think, grips all of us, and many who are parents are thinking, yeah, this is probably true. What's going on out there? How would you answer that?
One of the things that that research concluded, and I think it's somewhat unsurprising, is that the more embedded your teenager is in a religious community, you know, the better their outcomes are going to be. You know, it really didn't matter so much whether they considered themselves evangelical or Catholic or Jewish or any particular flavor of those things. It was more sort of, you know, those religious traditions tended to want comparable things for their kids. But if the kids themselves were not plugged in, if they were not embedded in the community, you know, they weren't going to get the messages. And so the simple fact of whether you call yourself a Baptist or a Methodist or a Catholic didn't matter much. What mattered is the extent of your involvement. Now, another thing we did discover, too, in that research was that a lot of the sort of decision-making around teenage sexuality is framed mostly in irreligious terms or a-religious terms, which is not inherently problematic. I mean, we would ask people, so why did you choose to abstain, if in fact they had? And a lot of the reasoning was sort of instrumental, which is, you know, I didn't want to get pregnant, or I didn't want to get somebody pregnant, or I've got my whole life to live, that sort of thing, which is fine. But, it's, you know, nothing distinctively faith-based about that logic. So we kind of found that embeddedness mattered more than mere identification as a Christian. And this sort of religious rationale or reasoning was pretty uncommon among teenagers, even among the devout ones.
Are you saying that religious beliefs really don't matter that much in how teens live their lives out in the world?
No, I'm not saying it doesn't matter. It just, when they articulate what matters and what motivates their decision-making in this area, sexuality, quite often what you will see is logic and rationale that is comparable across lots of domains, not just religious domains. So,
okay.
You know, when we think about sort of a more articulate, developed ethic around sexuality, teenagers largely aren't there. And you know, when you're 13 or 14, it's just this stuff is not on your radar. You know, it doesn't matter so much, I suppose, whether your kids have a sort of developed Christian ethic around the subject, but you'll want that to happen eventually, and so because it becomes more and more important when they become a tiny and tinier minority as they move out towards adult life.
Mm-hmm. Mark, as you have, as a sociologist, watched the trends of our population around the issue of sexuality in particular, what has happened with the teens over the last couple of decades? Has there been much change in behavior, or has it pretty much been about the same?
In terms of sort of baseline behaviors, there has not been a great deal of change.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you'll see an uptick or downtick that, you know, the Centers for Disease Control will talk about in things like, you know, the share of 17 or 18 year olds who have not had sexual intercourse. Typically, you'll see an uptick in the number who have not. And so
mm-hmm.
people will read into this all sorts of good news or what have you. And, you know, things fluctuate year to year statistically. It's not anything to get really worked up about. Certainly not something you can connect with a political project or program very easily. I think what has changed is a coarsening of attitudes about it. I mean, and it's really difficult to avoid. I mean, when I was 13 or 14, I played a lot of basketball. I wished girls would like me, but they really didn't seem to. But the whole subject was kind of largely off the radar, or at the edge of the radar screen for me. I don't think kids have that luxury today. You know, we had four TV channels when we were young, and now there's an explosion in media, you know, augmented even further by iPhones and things like that. So it's a kind of thing where their attitudes aren't necessarily shifting radically, but, you know, the information and sexualized content that they're exposed to, often not even, you know, intentionally, has increased. And so I think parents typically recognize the importance of starting conversations earlier. I don't think they actually do, but I think they ought to, which is true. And to sort of to navigate, help their teenagers navigate this domain rather than simply sending punitive messages about it. So it's I don't see a ton of change in teenagers' behavior. What I have seen is a coarsening in attitude and sort of a normalization of sexuality at an age, earlier ages than they would prefer, typically.
I would think that next to the printing press, the advent of the internet, the access of information to everybody of all ages is creating rapid change in our society in a way that's just never been seen.
Sure.
And certainly that opens the whole door of sexual understanding. It lowers the barriers, the social norms, doesn't it? That,
sure.
You know, only adults do this. Only adults
right.
see this. Only adults talk about this. Now suddenly it's out there for everybody.
Right. In the domain of sexual education, we've seen a radical reorientation. you know, it used to be something you'd pick up in books or a health class, things like that. And there is all sorts of political infighting about, you know, abstinence-based education, things like that. And people often fail to realize that, you know, a lot of people are getting their sex ed online, and which is, of course, disturbing because at the same time, I would say that's not real sex.
Yeah, yeah.
It is becoming more so, as, you know, in our latest project when we're interviewing 24 to 32-year-olds, I used to think that, oh, you know, men's exposure to porn would kind of, you know, would fly in the face of how they would have to navigate life with a real woman. But I think it's the other way around. Women are figuring out how to navigate a pornified life with real men, and that's discouraging, right? But that's fast-forwarding into the adult years, but the ground is being established for that in the teenage years, because the content to which they're exposed is something very different than when we were younger. You know, we'd steal glances at Sports Illustrated swimsuit issues.
Mm-hmm.
Imagination would run wild. Well, your imagination doesn't, I mean, you don't even need imagination anymore. So it's right there in front of you. So sex ed has changed considerably, and not for the better, obviously.
Yeah, and we'll come into the marriage issue later, but I suspect that younger and younger people are less concerned anymore about sexual mores and the norms that once were traditional. It's impacting marriage and family life. You wrote an article called Sex is Cheap, and on the Slate, I think you said it on your internet site, it was like number 11 in terms of hits. It's been gone all over the world. It's gone viral. Talk to us about that. What's it telling us?
Yeah, that's a... to set the scenario for that requires a little bit of background information. I wrote that piece largely because I had done analyses with the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, as it's now in young adulthood, and kind of looking at all the signals around what I would call the price of sex. It's not something I invented. Economists and social psychologists have been talking about that. Basically, this sort of idea, fairly old-fashioned but fairly stably accurate, that men's and women's relationships is characterized by our sexual relationships are an exchange, right? Men often seek something different in the relationship than women do. And so there was this classic idea about sex for resources, right? And we see that a little bit in old-fashioned advice, like, you know, why buy the cow and you can get the milk for free, right? Which is sort of this exchange idea. It's not very romantic, and I get that. But I think there's some accuracy to sort of the simple exchange that goes on between men and women in the domain of sexual behavior. And so I've been sort of calibrating a little bit indirectly, you know, how expensive are these relationships? Well, you think about how long do people wait in a romantic relationship before they begin having sexual intercourse? How much wooing is going on from men towards women? How many premarital partners do they have? I mean, do women prefer men with a lot of talent and future possibility? And all those things, the answer is no. I mean, mm-hmm. it's diminishing in its price, so to speak, right? Which, you know, historically, it got its largest price drop from the sort of the wide uptake of contraception. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Birth control takes the major risk of pregnancy out of sex. Okay. So not overnight, because it didn't come online overnight. The slow uptake over years and years and years of contraception and a mentality around contraception that sex does not necessarily entail this risk. The backup birth control of abortion availability followed about 10 years after that. And so you've got this sort of sex doesn't equate with pregnancy anymore, at least not directly so. I mean, it can be curbed, it can be rejected, etc. So what we've witnessed then over the past 30 sort of years is sort of this developing price drop in sex. It doesn't cost as much for men to access. women don't risk as much in having sex. And so I wrote this piece, basically, to describe what's going on in terms of the price of sex. And that's, you know, dramatically lower than it used to be, right? At some level, you know, people seem to be okay with that, right? It's not crazy about that. I think it'd be nice if people reserved it for a far greater price than they currently do. But, I mean, people vote with their feet. And so the thing is, like, women both want a higher price for sex, but, you know, have made their peace with the reasons for why sex is cheaper today than it used to be. So I typically argue that for the ability to control their fertility, women have largely traded away control over the speed with which their relationships become sexual. They still are the gatekeepers, so to speak, in their relationships regarding sex, but they feel much more constraint in terms of how much they can expect from men.
Yeah.
And part of this is because women don't need marriage in the way that they typically used to, economically, educationally, socially, culturally. And we praise some of those things. You know, we like it when people go to college and begin careers and things like that. At the same time, it means, you know, marriage is much more optional for everybody than it used to be. So there are some costs and benefits in this way, and my job largely is to try to sort of make sense of this, not to do strong advocacy, but at least help people to see what it is that's going on.
And one might say that while we've cheapened the price of sex, we've cheapened the value of it as well, and that has a great impact on the family, on marriage. Can you follow up on that thought, or do you disagree with me?
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well,
the value.
When I say value, if something...
Or the meaning, I say. I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. To me, that because our society has made sex so accessible that it's almost a commodity, it's caused relationships to be less hinged or tied to that experience.
Right.
And whereas it used to be seen and understood to be the private act between a man and woman in marriage,
right,
and an essential act, not just for having children, but it was like glue that held that relationship together. Now it's something sticky but fun to play with in any relationship.
Right.
And
right.
So it's I think it's become devalued in a sense, but it's definitely had an impact on marriage and therefore in family, as I see marriage to be the foundation of the family structure traditionally in our country.
Right, we do speak of sex and sexuality as sort of this individual commodity, and you know, one can always analyze it that way, even if people didn't speak of it that way. But it's certainly, people are using it in that manner, right? They speak of their sex life and things like that, which, you know, perhaps in a different era, it didn't make sense to speak of a sex life. You had a relationship, not a individual characteristic.
All right. Let's go into your briefly into the book Premarital Sex in America. Were there any startling findings that you brought into that book that was released in 2010?
Right. Yeah. Startling might be an overstatement. I think what I've been largely doing is giving people a language to sort of assess what they see going on around them. At the same time, one of the things that the book notes is that you know, parents often send their kids away to college and envision all sorts of, you know, threats and risks to their children, and the fact of the matter is college has always been somewhat of a sexualized place, but in terms of people who engage on campus, you know, there's always been you know, the fraternity mindset. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there's always, you know, plenty of people who choose not to engage and who don't enter that scene. So some of the things are sort of, you know, reassuring, I suppose, to some parents. But one of the things that I do talk about in that is sort of the dynamics that go on inside sexual relationships, which we just talked a little bit about.
Mm-hmm.
But also sort of, I talk about sort of, it's not so much a flight from marriage, but that, you know, in the attitudes of young American adults today. Marriage is something that's to be put off, to be tacked on to their life after their careers are in full bloom and things like that. And that has, a qualitative change over the last 20 to 30 years. And parents have largely encouraged that.
In some ways.
Especially for their daughters, as they watch divorce rates have climbed in the past, they've leveled off and even declined a little bit lately.
But that's because largely the increase of cohabiting, right?
There's a lot of that, obviously. And so people tend to be risk reductive, or parents are sort of encouraging, hey, don't fall in love too soon, don't commit to anything crazy. Very risk reductive approach, which ultimately can kind of, it reflects a shift in the purpose of marriage, I think, that people, this is a capstone to a completed young adult life now, rather than, as I've said elsewhere, the formative institution, right? Something that helps make you into something you weren't before. So we did see plenty of sort of shifting attitudes on marriage from young adults there.
You've written some interesting stuff, op-ed pieces, for example, on the benefits of early marriage. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Right.
We've got about 1 minute.
The beginning of my unpopular op-ed career, which continues largely unabated. I call it like I see it, and I try not to be heavy-handed, but give people information. That was, too, is sort of an outgrowth of this study of young adults and this sort of shift in imagination about the purposes of marriage and when it's optimally entered.
Mark, before we go forward, sure. I want you to hold your thought for just about 20 seconds. We're going to take a very brief break, and we'll be right back. Listeners, this is Mark Regnerus, and he's an associate professor of sociology at the University of Texas in Austin. He's got a lot to tell us, and we're talking now about whether marriage ought to maybe happen earlier than it does in our society. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening. To discover more about Beyond Words and the other ministries of Scripture Awakening, visit us on the web at scriptureawakening.com. While there, you can learn about our amazingly successful Bible reading program, B90, or Bible in 90 Days. You can review the extensive catalog of our versatile Bible study series titled Be Next. You can also download free podcasts from all Beyond Words programs. Check out B90, Be Next, and Beyond at scriptureawakening.com. Here once again is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
Mark, coming back to the discussion about the age of marriage, I know historically and still today in many cultures, people get married at a young age. Hormones start raging, and it's like, hey, patch them together. And it prevents a lot of the riskiness you were talking about before.
Right. Cultures vary widely in terms of age of marriage. Some of them far too young, of course, than any of us would agree is a good thing for men or women. One thing we see is sort of a variety of reasons that people give, and including that they can't afford it, right? Which I grew up in rural Iowa, and I'm not sure anybody could afford to get married. You'd get married in the church, and you had a reception in the basement, and the whole thing could probably be done for $500. A lot of people think, what they're working towards is this symbolic marker of attainment, meaning a big wedding bash, right?
Right, right.
So you have that to contend with. You have sort of ideas about, I don't even know who I am when I'm 23 or 24. I need to find myself. And I've heard other people say, that's a never-ending quest. People want to reinvent themselves at lots of different ages. So people also tend to equate marriage with, children, which is very old. And so people still kind of think, okay, well, I'm When I'm ready to have children, that's when I, you know, want to get married. And prior to that is when I want to focus on career and things like that. As if, you know, people didn't marry and work at the same time, you know. I try to poke some holes into some of the popular narratives because rationally they just don't make a lot of sense, okay? And people say, you know, oh, I want to spend my young 20s traveling. Like, well, so did I, but I didn't have any money. Much more able to travel when I'm 30 and 40 than when I was 20. But a lot of people, their parents resist the idea. Some of whom, you know, their parents married at 18 or 19, you know, and it crashed and burned for whatever reason. And they want to try to shield their child from making what they seem as a age-graded mistake. You know, age in marriage, I say, never causes a divorce. You know, it may be, it's often correlated with the divorce risk. But sort of, what it means is, you know, when you're young, there are some things about marriage that you may not have grasped well, or some stories about it that you believed too quickly. But, you know, it doesn't cause a divorce in the way that social scientists talk about causation. And finally, there's this, I would say, an emerging mentality about sexual chemistry, you know, delivered to us in a lot of different media sources these days, sort of the idea that, well, you've got to find the right chemistry with a person. And again, that means somewhat irrational. Couples learn their sexual relationship, and to think that, you know, I mean, that you have to be good at something before you get to it is somewhat ridiculous. And, I mean, human behavior is, you know, is learned behavior. So each of these sort of ideas and reasons that people give for delaying marriage doesn't really seem to hold water with me. But, you know, it's real in their minds and real in their, and it's how it shapes their attitudes. So we see, you know, generally fewer people marrying each year in terms of the share of people, and I guess we call it the marital sweet spot, 25 to 34 years old. But sort of the group, the time in which most people are married. That number can, you know, has dipped 10% in 10 years, which is a rather precipitous drop. So, and, you know, people delay the age at which they marry. So that's not going to, that rise in the age of marriage is not going to go on forever. It'll probably peak around 30 or 32, somewhat self-limited by the fact that most people still prefer their childbearing to be within marriage, even as we see, you know, non-marital childbearing rise.
Right, right. Let's go on. I want to make sure we get sure. Some real focus on the topic that is right now got you in the limelight. You've been in, I think I've seen NBC, Fox, you've probably been out in a lot of news outlets talking about this topic, and that is gay marriage and the impact it has on children. I've been researching this for some years, nowhere like you have. But I've noticed that over and over again, people said there's just not enough conclusive information, not enough data. Then the APA came out, American Psychological Association, for the sake of our listeners, in 2005, telling us that the evidence to suggest, I'm quoting, the evidence to date suggests that home environments provided by lesbian and gay parents are as likely as those provided by heterosexual parents to support and enable children's psychosocial growth. And that's sort of been what people have been writing on, largely until, I know there are a lot of people in the conversation, but your research, above all, I think, Mark, has been on a cutting edge and has challenged this assertion to some extent. So tell us about what you published recently and why it's making such an impact in the country.
Right. Yeah. Well, this subject is a really deep well, and
it is. It's what we
definitely
need to get
in the political eye at the moment. Let me try to start a little bit, you know, back to 2005 with the APA's statement. This is a tough subject to study, gay parenting, for the lack of a better term. I mean, when you start to say gay parenting, then you're like, oh, what do we mean by gay, and how do we measure that? And it gets, you know, it gets very complicated very quickly, and I have tried hard, probably need to try even harder, to sort of always be clear about the categories that I'm referring to, and, or that other people are referring to, because when we study sort of gay parenting, one can come at it from sort of a more simple kind of, well, let's start with some parents that we know who are gay or lesbian and who have children, and let's, you know, talk to them and let's keep track of them for a while. And so the largest or the most well-known, well, certainly most well-published, I think there's about 19, I think at least 19 peer-reviewed publications from this, is the National Longitudinal Lesbian Family Study,
mm-hmm.
Which is sort of what we call a snowball sample. It starts off with people who are interested in the study participating and referring others and that sort of thing. So far as I can tell, that's their method. Nobody's had access to the data except them. They don't give it away like crazy people like me. So it should be
in a way,
and other people should be able to evaluate it. So,
yeah.
So that study is probably, I mean, that's been one of the most well-cited data collection efforts. And it has value. It certainly shows what is possible. Okay. So in this domain, I always want to say, you know, this is not about that people cannot raise decent, well-adjusted, civically minded, educated kids in gay households. That's not true. We know that many things are possible, and a lot of things have to do with parenting and household dynamics that have nothing to do with sexual orientation of parents or the sexual behavior of parents and things like that. So that was sort of one of the sort of top-sided studies in the APA document back then. Along came me and some of it's just sort of watching what other people are saying in their studies as well. Looking at my study, and we wanted to say, oh, let's not do the snowball sample. Let's try to get a more random sample to improve upon the sampling approach, right? Because sociologists, at least, tend to want samples that are randomly generated, meaning we can talk more about an entire population rather than just sort of this group of people who we know or who signed up for the survey. So we went fishing for a random sample of same-sex households with children. Easier said than done, because this is not a large population to begin with, and I think everybody has a sense of that. But when you talk about sort of, okay, now what of that population has children? A smaller share. And so if you want to... So it turned out to be, I think, 1.7% of the population of young adults in the United States between 18 and 39 said their mother or father had had a same-sex romantic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
1.7%, right? So to find 1.7 more of those cases randomly, you have to fish through an awful lot of people on your way to the 1.7. If you want, you know, several hundred cases, which is what we wanted, right? We wanted 1,000.
Yeah.
It's difficult to get it today, and I think it would take a massive funded study, multiple millions of dollars, to locate enough cases.
And of course,
stably coupled lesbians and
right.
gay couples to track them for many years. That's just where the science, the ceiling for it is limited. So what we did is meaning my research team and I, evaluated the cases where the respondent, who's a young adult now, said they lived with their mother and father, that the mother and father had a same-sex romantic relationship. Now, most of the ones who said their father did not actually live with him for very long. More of them did with their mother. But very few lived with their mother and her partner consecutively for, you know, many years. So you can see sort of the ideal kind of sampling you want to do is very difficult to do given sort of limitations of the population that you're after. So what we did find is that people young adults who said their mother and father had a same-sex romantic relationship, you know, didn't fare as well either in the reflections upon their parents and life growing up or upon their current life in terms of socioeconomic measures and things like that, including measures of sexual behavior, than kids whose parents were married and still are married.
Mm-hmm.
So we divided into like 8 different groups, and then I went back and divided it into 15 different groups after people criticized the fact that I only divided it into 8. So, yeah, it's a minefield.
Yeah, basically what you're telling us, because our time's going to run quickly here, and
sure.
I want to get into the stuff the listener really wants to get their hands on. You've done a study with collected data from about 3,000 adults, and you've done a more comprehensive study than anything that's been done to the current date. Is that not true?
That's subject to some dispute, too. I think it's a solid study. I think we did the best we could with the data resources that were available. Others have studied the U.S. Census, but one of the problems with the census, much more cases, of course, extremely expensive, and we don't know about the sexual orientation of parents. I don't either. I only asked about their sexual behavior. So, yeah, it's one of the top few studies, for sure, and especially if you limit it to nationally representative samples of large size, it's certainly in the mix. So, but the kind of ideal study people think could be done is we're still a little ways away from that yet, and I think most social scientists would agree with me on that.
Yeah. Through the years, of course, a lot of evidence through study has shown that a man and a woman, male-female marriage that's stable, is better, a better environment context for raising healthy children than a single parent. And this is not to knock single parents. God bless you and may God strengthen you.
Right. Yeah.
But that's often been interpreted or just extrapolated right into the gay relationship, saying if you don't have one of each, it doesn't work. And others have said that's not fair. You need to have two men or two women that are stable over time to have a healthy comparison. And the problem is making such a comparison, is it not? Because it's hard to find these stable relationships in our country, even though there's probably more openness in some ways to gay parenting in our country than most countries of the world. But when you go to somewhere like Sweden, when you go to Scandinavia, where gay marriage has for some time now been acceptable by and large by society, and it's legal, we still find there's less stability, is it not true, for gay couples than for heterosexual couples in general?
Well, that too is a complicated question. There does appear to be what I guess what we call a lesbian effect. I detailed that in my November article, follow-up article in Social Science Research. Lesbian effect, where two women in a relationship tends to be a little bit less structurally stable, more prone to breakup, than either a man and woman or two men. Whereas we also know with two men that the risk of what we call non-monogamy, going outside the relationship, is a greater possibility. That's been documented not by me, but by some other sociologists, demographers. So, yeah, it's, you know, you try to tread carefully in this stuff because it's a lot seems to hang on it, and people are very sensitive to fine grade distinctions and things like that, and I've tried to reflect that. So, but suffice it to say that it's a dangerous field to write in.
It is. I want to quote, if I think our listeners would appreciate this. I read a number of the reviews of your research out there, and this from the more conservative Witherspoon Institute under public discourse, and certainly they helped to fund your study, but they write, I quote, "Within minutes, it seemed Professor Regnerus, a gifted and highly productive scholar with two previous books published on religious subjects, was denounced as anti-gay, attacked personally and professionally, and his thoughtful, measured research conclusions were buried under an avalanche of invective, abuse, and misunderstanding. The remainder of the summer months, Regnerus withstood an onslaught of criticism, but as the autumn arrived, it became clear that his reputation and the soundness of his research had been vindicated." What was it like for you? I know you've been under the fire with other publications. I imagine this was a lot more so than anything.
Yeah, this is a different order of magnitude. Yeah, it's not the most pleasant. It's been an experience. I assume that, you know, since I've written on it, it's, you know, the subject is not going to go away, even if I don't write much more on it, and I didn't intend to make it a career in terms of topics. So, but yeah, it's been interesting.
I'm going to read another. I'll just pick one randomly here. Here's from the New York Times. Is interesting, their write-up. Here's their first paragraph. Young adults from broken homes in which a parent had had a same-sex relationship reported modestly more psychological and social problems in their current lives than peers from other families that had experienced divorce and other disruptions, a new study found, stirring bitter debate among partisans on gay marriage. And they almost make light of it. They're showing very significant. What I think, Mark, as I'm reading your study and some of the scholarly journals and more popular controversy around it, is you've basically taken the study, supposedly sure and trustworthy results at APA, and you have said with your research, let's think twice. This may not be as accurate as they're claiming it to be. We need to do a lot more studies. Is that kind of how you conclude what you've done?
Yeah, I think that's a fair representation of a good position to hold on that. We've undertaken the study of this subject only for the last, roughly 30 years or so. And it's a small population, tiny minority, politically embattled. Also, sort of the issues around sexual orientation and people's self-identification as such, that has changed over time as well. So trying to get the best possible study in this domain is important, but subject to limitations to this point. And I think one of our criticisms of the APA's statement was that it didn't convey a great deal of limitations around that. And I tried to be fair about what my data analysis could say and could not say. People from the right and the left have been free to say what they wish about it, and some people inaccurately characterize it in one direction or the other direction. So, but my job as a scientist is to analyze it and put it out there and then give the data out so that people can take their own look. So that's what we did.
And I want to thank you for your work in this area. I think many people avoid it. It's easier to avoid research in this area.
It's definitely easier to avoid.
Because there's a huge engine of money and energy going into promoting this movement to affirm gay marriage. And whether I'm speaking up or down on it, I'd like to see good research done on all sides. And clearly that's the biggest issue that certainly the Supreme Court's been talking about, is that we don't have all the evidence yet. Yeah, I think about it this way, Mark. When we went as a nation in the 60s and 70s into the whole area of no-fault divorce, we had no idea what effect that would have on the family structure. I think we're going in the same track once again, and we should this time maybe take a second look and do a little more careful research.
I think the research properly done has nothing to hide.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a good thing, and everybody can use it. And different people will see different things in the data and say, "Oh, this means that we ought to do this next, or this means we ought to do that next." And people will bring their own interpretations to it. But I applaud quality data collection efforts, regardless of who's doing them.
I want to ask you about your perspective as a sociologist on the viewpoints now on gay marriage. Just in general, I see a 2011 Census Bureau how the family's changing. Back in 1960, 88% of children had two parents. In 2011, it's down to 69%, with 11% of children living with a divorced mother, 1.7 with a divorced father, 3.9 with unmarried cohabiting parents. And then we have the issue, the big unknown of how many have a gay and lesbian parenting model. Somewhere between 1 and 9 million. That's really unknown, isn't it?
It's hard to get good estimates, because the thing that you would typically lean on is the census, and the census doesn't ask questions about sexuality or sexual behavior or about religion, and most of the population prefers it that way. Social scientists, of course, always want more information than less, but we have to live with what we've got or try to do better ourselves. So the folks who look into the census to estimate gay or lesbian households do so looking at sort of the gender of household heads and other household heads in the household. And so it's an estimate, it's an educated guess, and it has some significant room for error. I know in Canada's, I don't know if it's a census, but recently they sort of discovered they were overestimating gay couples in Saskatchewan, you know, on the oil fields. And like, wait a second, I think these are probably not men in gay relationships. They're probably roommates, roughnecks working in the oil fields.
Yeah.
So it's tricky to get good estimates and without asking very blunt questions, which governments tend not to wish to do. So do the best we can with some obvious limitations and fairly low ceilings.
So what I was heading with my comments were that as we see society's norms changing and fewer children in households with the mom and dad, we see their viewpoints changing as well. Of course, a lot has occurred out in the media in the last few weeks about, you know, new studies. It's tilting now. Over half the people apparently support gay marriage. Primarily, I would suspect the questions are worded toward equality and rights, and they don't look at a lot of the other issues that you're looking at as a sociologist. But do you see a big tilt going on, or is it more the media happening?
No, I think there is a big tilt going on. Getting survey numbers on this is always subject to, you know, how you ask the question and whether you give a gradation of possible answers or sort of a blunt yes, no. So, you know, you can see good surveys and not so good surveys on this, and the media doesn't typically distinguish between those two very effectively. But
right.
in general, yeah, there's definitely an age-graded imbalance in support for gay rights in general, including same-sex marriage. Younger people being more on board than older people. And, you know, one of my students is writing a paper on the topic and said he can see this dramatic shift, you know, including in himself. He said, 2 years ago I was totally not on board with this, and now I think it's fine. So I think you can say that there's been a fairly effective effort to win hearts and minds on this.
Mark, we just have about 2 minutes left. Is there a final thing you'd like to say to our listening audience? I've poked around in a lot of areas. I know it was just very shallow, the things we discussed,
sure,
when you look at the depth of your research and study, but what is a kind of a final message you'd want us to hear?
I assume most of your listeners are sort of more traditional marriage fans, and I think there's, you know, that they should be mindful with their children, with their grandchildren, etc., to the importance of sort of instructing and educating, and just not assuming that your children will take up your own perspective on matters, and so the importance of sort of having a marriage culture benefits children, etc. But it's also, you know, it's good for spouses, and it's kind of like the default position, certainly for people in the church. I hear a fair amount emerge from broader evangelicalism about sort of, well, you know, singleness is very good and fine, and I totally affirm that. I mean, it's but I think you should be called to that. You know, it discourages me that I hear so many people who feel called to marriage, but they find nobody to marry or nobody to ask them. And I think people need to realize that this is something that needs to be nurtured, or it will naturally sort of shrink.
Mark, thank you again for being with us in the air, and thank you above all for all of your hard work through the years and the research you're providing.
You're welcome.
God bless you.
Thanks.
Thanks, listeners, for being with us today.
This has been Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening, and if you'd like to help support this ministry, or if you would like to know more about Beyond Words, visit us on our website at scriptureawakening.com.